a man who believes a lot of stuff that I believe about Alcoholics Anonymous, and is committed to it as much as I am, and works with others as I do. A good friend of any alcoholic in Bettendorf, Iowa, Ed M. Let's give him a big welcome.
Good evening. My name's Ed Mutum, and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
I'll be right back. I got to go get a card out of my room. Just wanted a little early start, that's all. I want to thank Charles for that nice introduction, and I want to thank you for loving me so well while I've been here. I love God, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love being sober, and I don't apologize for any of the three anymore. It was a long time in AA where I had to kind of soft-footed around that I was happy being sober, because a lot of people don't want to hear that, you know. They're in their mess instead of the message, you know, and the message that I've found here is happy, joyous, and free, and I didn't always find it that way in AA, because a lot of times I wasn't doing AA, I was doing Ed-A. And if you're like me and you do Ed-A from time to time, you get a little bit crazy. That's why you're always glad there's AA. And come back and do that. And I want to thank Jay and Charles. And I love Jay. I love you. And I don't want to ever forget to tell you that. Especially with recent events, none of us know what tomorrow brings. And we need to tell people we love them. And I love you with all my heart. If there's anything in my life I can ever give to you to make your life better, please let me do it. And that's just the way it is, and I don't want anything back. I've already been overpaid. For those of you who don't know me, no, I don't play basketball. Yes, I have trouble buying clothes, and the weather's fine up here, okay? Get all those out of the way. Yeah, we're done. And you don't make any smart-aleck comments about tall corn, and I won't make any smart-aleck comments about making hotels where hurricanes come, okay? And, you know, that comment, though, it's always in basketball states is really bad. And, of course, I got hot-tolly. And it's always by somebody's same two questions and by the same size person is, how tall are you? 6'10". Do you play basketball? No. How tall are you? 5'4". Do you play miniature golf? I think it's a fair question. And I want to thank my friend Jerry and Ron for taking me out today. We played miniature golf. Somebody got two hole-in-ones and led by six strokes, but I won't mention his name. But it was wonderful. They took me to the aquarium, and we walked around, and I just loved the world God has created. Same world I used to hate, if you're anything like me. I used to hate the fact that I was breathing. It's the earliest memory in life when you get right down to it, for me. I looked out at this world, and I said, I don't know what's going on, but I don't like it. And I don't like me. I don't know about you, but I was always coming up short, no pun intended. Yeah. It's like I always used to say, you know, I used to say I was always big for my age, and somebody said, you still are. You know, I guess I am. I didn't. But I identified with the wonderful speakers ahead of me. I mean, if you haven't gotten the message of Alcoholics Anonymous and Lieber's talk this morning, it was a wonderful talk, because so often I hear talks talking about them, and she talked about her and her program. And I can't wait to hear Dennis tomorrow, because I know we'll be blessed. And I grew up in a family where I was the youngest of seven children. And my father was a foundry worker, and he was the hardest working man I've ever known in my life. I remember when I was 16 years old, and he was in his 60s, I went to work with him and couldn't keep up with him. He was a hard-working man. He worked in the foundry in that molding sand. And I don't know if you've ever messed with that, but it's heavy, heavy stuff. And he worked hard. My mother always told us about the time during the Depression when you got a quarter a ton for shoveling coal, and he made $18 in one day. My dad was a hard-working man. Trouble is, he drank as hard as he worked. And sometimes he drank too much. And that's why a lot of the reasons why I didn't like what was going on. There seemed to be a lot of emotions going on. There seemed to be a lot of turmoil all the time. And I come from a very elite group of people called white trash, and we worked hard to uphold our image. You know, there wasn't much doubt about it. When we walked down the street, you know, we did it right, had the floppy shoes and the whole bit. And I remember thinking I was too sensitive. I didn't know that word, of course, when I was little, but when you break it down, that's what it was. I thought, why would people say mean things to me because I don't have nice clothes? Why would people do that? Why do people make fun of other people when they don't have nice things? Why would they do that? Why do they tell me I smell bad? I bathe on Saturday night just like everybody else. Why don't they want me on their team when we're playing? I don't know about you, but I was glad when I started drinking. And it didn't do anything miraculous for me. Miraculous isn't the word that I equate with evil. And what booze did with me was downright evil. It eventually got me to the place where I couldn't say no to it anymore. In spite of how much I wanted to, in spite of how many times I promised that I won't do it again, you could have put a lie detector on me and it would have registered truth. Because I meant it every single time I said it. And I was almost as heartbroken as those relatives and those faces. I don't know about you, but I was full of memories and what might have been's and if only's. And that look in my mother's eye one more time when I did it again, or that wife one more time when I spent all the money. I didn't mean to hit her. I was always one of those guys that talked in the bar about if anybody abused anybody, if anybody wanted to beat on a woman, they should try me on. Never bothered telling what went on from home, just from time to time, but one time's too much. And if you do things like that, you have to drink. And if you drink like I drink, you end up doing things that you have to drink to forget. And when that vicious cycle starts, guess what? There's no sobering up anymore. Now, I forgot where I was at. I got to start all over. My name's Ed, and I'm an alcoholic. And I was real grateful. Alcohol didn't do anything miraculous, but what it did is it took all the edges off. It made life survivable, and I am so grateful for alcohol and everything else I ingested. I was not one of those people that said, oh, what is that you're giving me? Before I take it, I'd like to know the effects. I wasn't, thanks. Oh, yeah? Thanks very much. I didn't care. The one thing I knew is I didn't want reality. I came to my first AA meeting when I was 10 years old. Me and this thing's going to fight. When I was 10 years old, I've got a brother here in South Carolina, sober 44 years. He's so dry, I don't let people smoke around him. And he took me to that A&A meeting, you know, and I remember there was some old burnout up there about 30, and I thought, so this is where old people come, you know. And he said, my name's Fred, and I'm an alcoholic. I thought, good for you, Fred. And he kept telling me I'd be here one day. I said, not quite. I'm a little too hip for this deal. At the ripe old age of 13, I was arrested by the Iowa Highway Patrol for possession of a sawed-off shotgun, a double-barreled 12-gauge that was 14 inches long. I don't have to ask what happened to the kids in Columbine. It was happening in my neighborhood for years. Just when it got out in the better neighborhoods, did people start talking about it. I had already decided you weren't going to hurt me anymore. That no matter what, you weren't going to hurt me. And at a very early age, people started telling me, you know, you keep this up, you're going to die. And I thought, really? You promise? That's no threat to me. It would have been a break. It's the only lie I've ever been told in AA. They said, you keep this up, you're going to die. I was counting on it. I was hoping you'd take me out, because you see, when I'm sober, I want to explode. When I'm sober, my head's going 900 miles an hour. And all I seem to think of is what I've done to other people I love. And what I didn't do that I should have done. And how worthless I am. And if you're anything like me, the only thing that'll take the edge off that's a little drink, a little something. And you don't want reality. That's the last thing you want. When I was 16 years old, I met this woman who had a sufficiently bad reputation, so I asked her to marry me. I didn't want to risk rejection. God bless her, she said yes, and she found out she got the bad end of the deal, you know. I was married to that woman, and I saw me do to that woman what I saw my father do to my mother, and I told you I would never do ever. God, the remorse and the guilt there. I'd never do that, ever. My kids would never see that, ever. Guess what? I'm a loser big time, man. I'm a loser big time. I'm not worth much at all. So you drink some more. It's the only thing you can do. Only thing you can do. When I was 18, I was committed to the Iowa State Mental Institution. They termed me psychotic, neurotic, insanely violent, hopelessly addicted to drugs, and chronic alcoholic, and I said, thanks for the vote of confidence. We appreciate it. But they were absolutely right. The diagnosis was exactly as it should be for the way I was behaving and living at the time. I walked around and I learned to perfect the Thorazine shuffle. And that was kind of nice. They tell you things like, if you get upset, tell us and we'll make you feel better. Well, I got upset every 4 hours on the spot, I'll tell you. And I'm real grateful they didn't have treatment centers then. I would have really been in a world of trouble. I would have put that guy on the hot seat, you bet. January 5th of 1971, I got sober. Didn't mean to. It wasn't in my day planner. My five-year plan just wasn't there. I was in a car wreck like I'd been in a car wreck many times. And I don't say that braggingly. I say that by God's grace. I'm alive. I have no tolerance for drunk drivers anymore. In fact, if I'm in back of you, I'll get on my cell phone, I'll ride your bumper till I pick you up, and then I'll give my card so I can testify. I buried one too many nice people because of stupidity. God, I think of that now, what I used to do. And I remember I was in a car wreck, and I was laying in the middle of the street, and it was 18 below zero, and it was one of those Iowa ice storms where everything's coated with about a quarter inch of ice, and it's just a mess. I'm laying there, and the police come up, and they said, that's Mutum. Don't touch him. He's the scum of the earth. Car's probably hot. Just let the SOB die. And something happened that never happened before, because I'm a cop fighter. Now, there's another dumbest profession you can ever get in. If you're a cop fighter, I got news for you. There's always more of them. I didn't know that. And you know what? I laid there and I agreed with them. For the first time in my life, I had no defense for what I'd done. There was no one to blame but me. It was real clear to me that I was laying in the middle of the street as a result of my best judgment, the finest ideas I could come up with, in the middle of the street. And they took me up to the hospital, and it was funny because I was they called me a junkie back then. That's not fashionable anymore, so I don't know what it is, but junkie and a drunk is what they said, and they wouldn't let me in the hospital because it was a moral issue, but because I was in a car wreck, they had to let me in. I remember they rolled me by this nurse, and some nurse said, Ed, do you want me to call AA? And I went, might as well. I want to know why you new people can't be sincere like we were in the old days, you know? I sat there, and the next day a guy come in, and he's smiling from ear to ear. That's what you really want to see when you've been banged up in a car wreck and hung over and some happy member of AA to come in, you know? And his name's Hap. Honest to God, Happy, you know? And he walks in and he said, and I'm ready for him because I'd been to A&A. I had heard it all. You're not even dry behind the ears. I spilled more than you ever drank. I was 20 years old. And by that time, I'd married, divorced. I told you I was incarcerated and what I was termed. I had records as long as both arms, and people were telling me, you haven't even been around the block yet. And I thought, how big is this block? If it's much bigger, somebody else is going to have to do it. And it's real important for me to share that because we have a tendency when young people come in to AA to say, well, you haven't been where I've been. I got a flash for you. It may have been worse. How old do you have to be to die of cancer? How old do you have to be till it's terminal? Doesn't matter how old you are. If you got it, you got it. And I was ready for him. I had an answer for everything he'd throw out. And you know what he said to me? He said, welcome home. And I hadn't heard that maybe forever. I don't know. And I didn't have an answer. And he said, we don't drink and we don't use one day at a time. And for some reason, I got honest and I said, I can't make it a day. I just need to tell you, I can't make it a day. And that was from the bottom of my heart. And he said, all you do is try, Ed, one day at a time. We don't drink and we don't use one day at a time. That was January 5th of 1971, and from that date to this, I have had no alcohol or mood-altering chemicals in my system. So I'm one of those that don't believe that, oh, God bless you. I'm one of those that believe that Alcoholics Anonymous in this big book works just fine if you crack it open. You know, get it off the coffee table so people don't think you're reading it when they come by, you know. Get the coffee rings off of it and maybe crack it open and see what's in there. It actually works, and I was very blessed to be around a lot of people who knew Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started going to meetings. And I remember, I don't know about you, but I had a bad experience in church when I was a kid. Real bad. First off, all ministers have thin blue lips, talk like this. You know. At least that's the one I had. And they always looked at me and said, you're going to burn in hell. That's what you're going to do. You're just going to burn in hell. And my mother was very religious and didn't drink. And my dad, well, I told you about my dad. I'd go there, and every time he was going to burn in hell, and they said something that just made me crazy. They said to me, God is responsible for everything. God is responsible for everything, for every hair on your head. And I used to wake up in the middle of the night when I was a kid, and I'd turn on the light, and a million cockroaches would run everywhere, and I'd crush them as I'd walk over that floor, and I'd shake off a glass to get a drink, and I'd think, God is responsible for everything. When they took my big brother, who was my hero, to Fort Madison State Penitentiary again, God is responsible for everything. When my cousin was killed and hit by a truck, and people come up and say, God must have wanted an angel. And I'd think, so he hits you with a truck? God is responsible for everything. I got to thinking real soon, I don't want to play with this guy. Certainly don't want to pray so he'll know where I'm at. The other thing is, he's got lightning, and if he finds you... So God and I separated company a long time ago. And I was pleased about it. I hear a lot of people come into AA and said I was atheist or I didn't believe. I need to tell you that I believed in God a lot and hated everything I believed. Everything. There's a line in our book that talks about being violently anti-religious. I must tell you, that's the way I was. You brought that stuff up to me, we're just going to fight. You brought up that Jesus character, we're really going to fight. Because if there's a God, why'd all this stuff happen? You answer me that. Why are there kids starving in the world? Why so many people dying of cancer? Where's your God then? And you know what they told me when I came to AA. You know, you got to find a relationship with God. And I like, they told me, but the good news was they said, God, as you understand him, and what I urge you tonight is find a God you understand. I don't care what you've been taught. I don't care what you think you're supposed to think. I ask you to take a minute and find out what you really believe. and start there. If we can't have an honest relationship with God, who are we kidding? If we can't start from where we're at, who are we lying to? Not God. And I had to dig because, you know, there was old-timers in AA, and they would sit around and they'd talk about this God, and I'd look in their eyes and they were telling the truth. I spent a lot of time on the streets. I knew whether you were lying or not. And I didn't get it. I'd look in the eyes and they were talking about love, and they were talking about God, and they were talking about caring, and I didn't get it, but I knew that they meant it. So I made a major mistake. I started professing a faith I didn't have. Started parroting the words I heard in AA. I became so spiritual, I was of no earthly good. And like I was telling you, those thin blue-lipped ministers, when you're sober about 6 months, you get honesty. At about 8 months, you get a little tact to go with it. My suggestion is wait for the tack, just, you know. I was about 6 months sober, and Father Tom was in our group. And Father Tom said, Ed, why don't you come back to church? And I had that honesty part, and I said, I'll tell you why I don't go back to church. It's full of thieves, hypocrites, and liars. And it felt good. He looked back at me and said, why don't you come? One more won't hurt. I punished him. I didn't talk to him for quite some time, I'll tell you. When I was new, you want to get me distance, tell me the truth, you know. Except when I saw Father Tom last week and he said, I love you, Ed, and I said, I love you too, Tom. I remember the first guy we were talking about today, Jay and I were talking about it a little bit. The first guy to come up and put his arm around me, he said, I love you. And I said, don't play that stuff, man. I'm just here to get sober, you know. And when I saw John last week, he said, I love you, Ed. And I said, I love you too, John. With all my heart, I love you. You see, I always thought the world was sick. I didn't know I was sick. I thought I was bad. I didn't know I was sick. And I thought I really wasn't worth saving. I had the same feeling all of us did, I think, is if you knew what I had done, you wouldn't even talk to me. I'm so ashamed of what I've done. You wouldn't even talk to me. And I came into an AA group that said, you know, I had to start being honest. And I thought, okay, I'll cut down on stealing a little bit. Just do enough to make ends meet, you know. Had to quit it all. Had to quit it all. And then they said, I had to start being honest with how I felt. Man, what an order. I can't go through with it. Because I really had no idea. You see, I'd been lying for so long, I had no idea what the truth was. These people who go through 28 days of treatment and say they did an inventory, I'm not sure I was given my right name at the end of 3 months, you know. So if you've done that, I urge you to do another inventory now that you're home. Find a sponsor that knows what an inventory is about. And if he's just going to sit there and nod, or she's going to sit there and nod, she doesn't know what an inventory is. She needs to crack open that 12 and 12, and it'll tell her what to do, or them to do what to do. And I went to meetings. And I was amazed because it may not mean much to you, but people invited me into their house and left, and they had nice stuff. That touched me. I couldn't believe that. I hear people say all the time, you know, I can't love anybody else until I love myself. Not my experience. I loved what you did to me. I loved what you did for me. I loved you long before I could love me. In fact, the way you loved me taught me how to love me. That maybe I had a little bit better coming than I deserved, than I thought I deserved. And I started working the steps, and I was about a year sober, a little over a year sober. And Dad invited me over for supper. Now, that may not be an event for you, but when it happens in my house, I'm usually in trouble. And I just celebrated my year's birthday, and Dad invited me for supper. And you had told me that I need to go into old situations with new attitudes. So that's what I did, and I walked into supper that night, and Dad and I were sitting down, and about halfway through supper, he went, boy, and I went, here it goes. He said, I just want to tell you I'm proud of you. And If you had told me I'd wanted that old fool's approval, I would have said, you're crazy. It doesn't mean anything to me. That was the best night of my life up to that point. I think I popped a couple buttons on my shirt, you know. And it was one of those gifts you get in AA that you never dreamed possible. And God just gives it to you. His grace just gives it to you. And it was special. And I went to that meeting that night, and I went to my sister-in-law's afterwards, and my mother called, and she was crying and hysterical and said, Ed, come home quick. Dad went across the street to get him a quart of beer and me a bottle of pop, and now they're carrying bodies out, and I don't know what happened. And I had that faith that now that I'm believing in God, nothing can happen to me because I believed all that stuff I've been spewing. It wasn't mine, it was yours, but I was spewing it, so I thought, okay. And I remember driving across town, and I went up to that bar that I had drank many years in. And I walked in, and it was funny, those police officers in there had shaped up in that year. You don't swing at them, they don't arrest you. Isn't that amazing? But in that year I'd been sober, you taught me that I had to pay back immediately what I'd been given, so I'd been working through the courts to get people, and they knew I was sober. And I walked in and I said, what happened? And they said, we don't know, Ed. All we know is somebody come in and just opened fire, shot everybody. I looked down the bar and I saw a pool of blood with my father's glasses all smashed up in it. And kind of knew. And I said, where'd they take everybody? And they said, they took them up to the hospital, Ed. And I said, okay. And I went in my car and I went up there. And again, ice storm night, January 19th. And I went up there to the hospital and there was an officer up there that hadn't forgotten me. How I used to be. And he said, what are you doing here? And I said, I'm here to see if my dad's here. He said, hey, your old man isn't here. I've identified everybody. Now get out of here before we bust your behind. And God's grace just happened. And I looked at him and said, okay. A little over a year before that, they would have been looking for a new lieutenant. But by what you taught me by your example, let him live. And I went home and I called the guy I'd least expect to call. He was the officer who spent the last 5 years of my drink and tried to put me away. But I knew he knew I was sober. And I said, Bob, my dad was in that tavern. He said, oh my God, Ed. And he said, he fed me information as it come in. We come up with, he must have been shot or he wandered outside or they took him hostage. That's all we can figure, so we'll form a search party. What I think of those families in New York and those search rescue parties, I would not wish that on anybody, just anybody. I wouldn't wish it on him. I had a gift that you had given me, and it was called that serenity prayer, and it's the only thing that had come into my head. I said it one word at a time, and if I said it once, I said it 10,000 times that night. And at 8 o'clock the next morning, that officer called me up and said, well, Ed, anybody could have made a mistake. You want to come up and identify your old man? And I said, sure. And I went up there to the hospital and I walked into that morgue and I saw that bullet hole in my father's face. And it just got cold. Because you see, something else I was taught about God is he's got a little book and every time you goof up, he keeps track. And I really thought maybe he killed Dad for all I'd done. And I was mad. I was hurt. And I've had to cause in the last few years to review that incident a number of times. And you know, as I review it, when I left that hospital and I went out, just in my peripheral view was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, most of them didn't say anything at all, but their presence said everything. Everywhere I went, to the police station, to the funeral home, eventually to the trials where I had to testify against the five young men that found it necessary to wipe three people off the earth. Six they left for dead because they didn't like their color. The height, the stupidity. Everywhere I went, there was a member of AA there. And I remember we went to the funeral, And God, I was looking for some answers. I'll tell you, I was really looking for some answers because the old anger, and I had that rage. I had that rage that God has taken from me, and I'm real grateful for that. Because it was the rage where you get locked up sooner or later. And I was sitting in that funeral, and the priest said something that I needed to hear. He gave me a key to the kingdom, and I hope it's a key to the kingdom for you, for what just happened. He said, you know, God created human beings, and He gave us all a free will. They chose to do this act, and now it's God's will. Do you mean God didn't kill Dad to punish me? No. Not at all. God, that just lifted the weight of the world off my shoulders. You mean the reason kids are starving because we're not feeding them? Don't blame it on God? Yeah, that's right. You mean the reason cancer's so rampant we can't catch up with it is because we're polluting everything we touch and want to blame it on God? Absolutely. God isn't doing this. We are. And there was no act of God September 11th. That was the greatest act of evil I've ever seen in my life. But I've seen God since then. Everywhere I look, I see God everywhere. We went through the murder trials, and I was called to testify, and there was this one guy there, and he was young, and he had an attitude, and I know how that was. But that's, you know, once you get sober, I'll tell you something. After you get sober, at least in my case, if you see something that really annoys you, you're looking at a mirror how you used to be. And this guy was smart, and he was cocky, and he was just a punk. And I thought, you know, you give me 5 minutes in the back room with this guy, we don't need a trial. And they sentenced him to 3 life sentences and 135 years, and he wasn't ever going to go anywhere, and I was pleased about that. The other guys got sentenced, and I went on about my life. But I did a couple things wrong. Number one, I didn't have a sponsor. I sat down with a couple people and tried to tell them how I felt when someone was needlessly murdered. For the first time in my adult life, I don't have to share that with you because now you know after 9/11. You know how heartbreaking it is for needless, wanton violence. That's just for ridiculous reasons. I sat down and told him at that time with not much of a program, I said, I want to even it up. I've been taught 20 years, an eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth, and I know that county jail by the back, like the back of my hand. And they got up and walked away. And they said, I thought you had a good program. They're not around here anymore. They got drunk some years ago. Alcoholics Anonymous is where we can work through these things. These 12 steps work when you're going through the worst time you could ever imagine in life. That's their value. Equal to when it's good. That's their value. And so I would suggest to you that you surround yourself with people that will walk with you where you're at rather than where they'd like you to be. That's what I love about AA, you see. Because we're the only organization I know that will come to you and walk with you from where you're at. You don't have to act anyway to get here. Just come. And if you can't come, we'll pick you up. Isn't that wonderful? God talked to me one day. Now, you got to be careful when God talks to you. But God talked to me and said, Ed, go out to California. Get into show business. Okay. Made perfect sense to me. I looked at my resume. And I went to where all stars get their start, Anaheim, California. I was goofy. Little did they know how well I fit the role at that point. But I actually got the job, but I never started it. I was going to meetings, and I was stark raving sober. I was 2.5 years sober, and my days consisted of, I don't want to live anymore. This life is too painful. AA seems nice for you guys, and it seems to be working for you. But I don't think it's going to work for me. Wish it would. And when you ask me how I was, I say, fine. And you? Nice to see you. We all know that answer. How are you? Fine. You? How about, you know, I'm thinking of driving into bridge abutments. How are you? But that's what we got to say. Because if you're going to be sober a long time in AA, guess what? It'll take you on every emotional ride you've ever been on in your life. And you better be able to be around people where you can be honest and they can work with you where you're at. Or it's going to kill you. At least that was my experience. And by accident, I went up to a meeting in West L.A., and I went up there, and everybody was active, and they were doing things, and it was fun, and it was just great. And I saw this one guy directing a lot of people, and I went up there the next week, and I said, "Excuse me, would you be my sponsor?" And he said, "No." I thought, that's kind of rude. I know the rules. You got to, you know. And he said, "Anybody I sponsor has to look up to me." I thought, oh, good, tall jokes. We'll be happy together, you know. And he said, "If you agree to do a few things, I'll be happy to sponsor you. My name's Clancy." And I am so grateful I didn't hear half the garbage that goes on about that man, because you would have killed me. You would have killed me. I would have been dumb enough to believe you. I'm not much of a fan for gossip in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know? I may not like what somebody does. I may not like their group. I may not like a lot of things, but I'm going to give you the dignity of your own decision and not put by any bias I have. And what I found was a guy who looked into my eyes and saw me stark raving sober and knew that I was dying. He knew my life was on the line. And he just said yes. He didn't ask me where I come from, what I did, how long I'd been sober. He just saw someone dying in front of him, sober. As there are people here tonight dying sober. And he said, "You know, you got to start working those steps." I said, "How do you do that?" He said, "They're in black and white, big fella." And I wasn't on top of the world financially, so I lived in his garage for 6 months, getting a little start. And he said something one night, and I offered my opinion to him. And he said, "If I want your opinion, I'll come out to my garage and ask you for it." But you see, I needed that. I needed someone to stop my nonsense, to someone to stop my mouth. Teach me how to put this in gear before I put this in gear. I needed that because what I thought I knew was killing me. And I thought I knew it all, and I thought that I had to pretend like I knew it all, or you wouldn't like me, or you'd ask me to leave. And I remember he had me write another inventory. And I wrote 4 days and four nights, and I just finished up the inventory, and I went into the house to have a cup of coffee with Charlotte Clancy's wife. Well, it is a strange relation, no. But can you race that buck? I'm in big trouble with that one. And I said, "Charlotte, I finished my inventory." She said, "Oh, that's wonderful." And I had that cup of coffee, and I went back out to the garage, and Clancy had a goat named Alfred at that time, and it was just finishing off the last page. I got crazy. I went in and said, "Charlotte, that goat in my inventory." She said, "Oh, my God, I hope you don't get the run." You know? And I thought, there's a typical Al-Anon answer for you, you know. I went up to Clancy and I said, "Clancy, that goat ate my inventory." He said, "Bet you found that hard to swallow, ha ha ha." And honest to God, 3 days later, the goat died. I felt bad. True story. Something about an obstruction of some size, you know what I mean. But he started teaching me things that I found in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He just put them a little differently. He told me one thing. He said, "They don't lock you up for how you think. They lock you up for how you act. I don't care what you think. You watch how you act." And I remember he pulled a lot of strings. And he's a real powerful guy in Southern California. He pulled all these strings, got me this great job as a bellhop from 11 to 7. And I had this wonderful little blue coat and a little blue hat. Just got a tad of anger going. And little old ladies would come in and drop their bag on my foot.
And they'd say, pick up that bag.
And I'd think, which one? You or it? I'm allowed to think that, he said. What I did is I said, yes, ma'am. And I picked up the bag and I went upstairs and I put it in the room and I flipped it open and I went to the door to wait for my tip. He shut the door and liked to break my fingers. And I'm thinking, I'm going to kick in the door, grab this old broadsword out the window and watch her splatter. But what I did is I said, thank you. And I went downstairs. Now, that doesn't sound like much. But it's the reason I'm a free man tonight. It's called freedom from the bondage of self. You see, if I thought it, I thought I had to do it. I didn't know that my feelings were not facts. I thought they were. That may sound silly to you, but I thought if I thought it, it was true. And I had to do it. God, what a freedom. Step three. And then he kept insisting I do better than I think I can. I can remember, I can sum up sponsorship, and I believe in sponsorship wholeheartedly. And I can sum up his sponsorship with me with one little story. I'm in his back garage one day, and I'm shaving. And he come in and said, what are you doing, kid? And I said, shaving. I was in the back garage there, and I went in, and he came in, and he looked at me, he said, well, here, wait a minute. He said, turn on the hot water. I said, okay. He said, let it get nice and warm. He said, now put that on your face and soften your whiskers a little bit. I said, okay. He said, now reach up there and get some soap or some shaving cream and put that on. I said, oh, okay. He said, now shave. I thought, oh. You see, I learned to shave when I was 13 years old in Scott County Jail. You pick up a razor and you shave. You don't ask. You don't ask unless you want a little fight on your hands. I didn't know. And I'd rip my face to shreds for years. I just thought that's what you do when you shave. Sponsors give you a better way to do things. You know, and I'm so glad he did. I remember when I was a kid, I had a real bad speech impediment. And I talked like this. And I talked like that all the time, and people would react, you know. And I remember they sent me to the speech therapist because it was really bad. And they sent me to this therapist when I was in like second or third grade. And she started having me play with blocks. And I think, blocks, you made me play with blocks. I don't like blocks. I don't like blocks. Don't like nothing about it. No. I'm tired of playing with blocks. She keeps talking and talking, making me play with the blocks. I play with the blocks. And then one day she said to me, you can go home now, Ed. You don't have to come back. And I said, why? I had no more impediment. She diverted my attention enough by the blocks to solve my problem. It's kind of the way God does it with our steps. To divert our attention to what we think is the problem to get to the real problem. And help us. And I believe solve our problem. I'm not one of these that sits around people say, you know, I still got a lot of defects. I said, cool, just take them to the other side of the room, you know. If you are not concerned about working on them, I'm not concerned about hanging out with you. None of us are ever going to be perfect. But we can't stop trying to live a better way. And I started all over with God. I realized that I hadn't believed in a God. And my first honest prayer ever, I got down on my knees and I said, God, I don't know if you're there or not, man. I sure hope so. It was as honest as I could be. And I was asked to speak in Pasadena, California. Oh, man, I got to get going. Pasadena, California. And I thought, ooh, wealthy area. I might go over there and hook up with something, you know. And I caught myself and I went right into my bathroom, got down on my knees, and I said the same prayer I said up here in the hotel before I came down. And I said, Father, let me go share the miracle you've performed in my life through Alcoholics Anonymous. Save me from my own nonsense, and I don't want anything out of this deal. I'm so sorry. And I went and I talked, and the guy came up to me afterwards and said, this makes no sense to me. I want to offer you a job. I said, it makes perfect sense to me. And I'm there with the seventh grade education. He said, have you ever been to Taiwan? I said, no. He said, have you ever been in show business management? He said, no. He said, be in my office Monday morning. I went to his office Monday morning. I talked to this producer who had been with NBC for 25 years. On Monday, on Thursday, I was lifting out of LAX. I was going to Taipei, Taiwan. I was the new vice president of America on Ice. I had a cast of 63. I was going over there to negotiate contracts with the Taiwanese government and flying back and forth to Hong Kong to build the costumes. What are you guys doing? Now, I'm going to tell you something, and if you hear nothing else, hear this. Say yes to opportunity. God knows where you've been. He wouldn't put it there if he didn't think you were worthy of it. You know, I didn't go in my head once, well, I got a seventh grade education. I'm not quite bright enough to do this. I've never done this before. You know, a lot of us like being losers. It's comfortable. It's familiar. And happy, joy, so we'll go back to what's comfortable and smear it all over us, you know. It takes a little faith to step out there and be happy, joyous, and free. It takes a little faith to walk toward the light instead of stay in the shade. And by God's grace, I just walked toward the light. And I was over there in Taiwan. I got off in Taipei, Taiwan. Everybody's this tall. And they're looking at me, and I'm looking at them, you know. And I know it's just a matter of time before they pull out that rope and tie me down. And a lot of wonderful things happened over there that I don't have time to get into tonight. But while I was over there, a guy walked by me who was there and saw what I did. And all I did is what you taught me. Suit up and show up. Be responsible. Care for others. Turn your eyes outward. And this guy walked by me one day and said, you know, you'd be an excellent manager for the Harlem Globetrotters. And I went, yeah, good. And I went home. And 3 months later, I got a call from the Harlem Globetrotters. Said, Mr. Mutin, we've heard wonderful things about you. Would you come up and talk to us? And I said, sure. Because I walked toward the light. And I went up there and they said, tell me a little about yourself. And I told them it all. Why lie? You told me I got nothing to hide anymore. It can't hurt me anymore. And it doesn't. And I told them a story and they said, congratulations, you're the new manager of the Harlem Globetrotters. Now, I'm going to tell you something. When I lived on the streets of Davenport, Iowa, on East 6th Street, and I was filthy and I was stinky and people made fun of me, I had a dream that I'd travel all over the world and I'd meet kings and queens and presidents and I'd go first class. And people laughed at me. When I came to AA, you told me, reclaim your dream. And I'm telling you now, I don't care how old you are. Reclaim them. That's what God wants you to do. I believed you. I started traveling the world first class, meeting kings and queens and presidents because of what you told me. Just because of what you told me. I went to London and I met the daughter of the Turkish ambassador. She was beautiful, wealthy, Muslim. I said, our backgrounds were a lot alike, so we got married. And we were married for 10 years and we have 3 beautiful children. And we used to fight a lot and we made up a lot. That's why we have 3 children. And she's a wonderful woman that we have a lot of differences. And 25 years ago, my ex-wife told me something when she came to this country. She said, Ed, these people are spoiled rotten. And I said, what do you mean? She said, you've never lost life on your land here. You don't know what it is. She was raised on the island of Cyprus, where there's war all the time. She said, you're spoiled. You don't know what it is to have your freedom threatened. You don't know what it is to lose life on your homeland. September 11th, I called her and I said, we're not spoiled anymore, are we? She said, no, sorry. Sorry. For some reason, I got involved and it was so subliminal, I didn't even know it. Material things became my God. Didn't mean it. Was not my intention. But all of a sudden, I'm living in Burbank, and I'm driving the Mercedes, and I'm making the big bucks, and I'm, you know, hip, slick, and cool, and I'm going to meetings, and I'm doing all this. But quietly, things out here became my God again. And through a series of decisions based on self and out of selfishness and greed, I lost everything I owned. It was nobody's fault except mine. Major error in judgment. I didn't talk to my sponsor about it. I didn't pray about it. I got greedy, and it cost me everything I owned. And I remember as they were evicting me from my apartment at 18 years sober and repossessing my car, that I was grateful that I learned that I got to get back to who my God is, not who it isn't. And I went back to Iowa, and I come back to Iowa in 1988, and I started all over. I had lost everything. About 70 or 92, 93, God talked to me and told me to quit smoking, so I quit smoking. Jerry, if you're downstairs, put out that damn cigarette. And, anyway. Just sharing my experience, strength, and hope. But I quit smoking, and they told me to exercise and start getting in shape, so I started running, and I broke my leg. And I got my foot propped up and, kind of doing an inventory about 92, and, I'm kind of patting myself on the back. It's been since 88, and I got this little apartment house there that I live in. I got a little apartment. Things are going okay. I'm kind of going, and all of a sudden God said, "What about education?" And I went, "La, la, 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 la." He don't care. He doesn't have call waiting. He just comes right back. "What about education?" And I started immediately in my head, "Do you understand? I've been manager of the Harlem Globetrotters. I have traveled all over the world. I've run major corporations. I've run about..." And all the while I'm doing this, I pick up my crutches and I go over to the college. Because after a while, this don't count. And I walked into the college and I said, "I'd like to go to school." And they said, "How many credits do you have?" I said, "I have bad credits." "Why? What's the deal with that?" And they laughed just like you did. But I was able to share one of the greatest gifts you give me, and I thank you for it every day. I looked them right in the eye and said, "You don't understand. I don't know how to go to school. I don't know if I'm bright enough to pass a class. But I want to try. Would you help me? I don't know if I can do this." And they said, "Sure, Dad." And they loved me. There's people outside these rooms that'll love us if we let them. And I started going to school, and I went to work full-time, went to school full-time, and didn't give up any of my commitments in AA, and always remained active, and I had about 60 hours in. And one weekend I went on this Christian retreat, and I had no less than a spiritual awakening. It was on a Saturday night, and God changed my heart, and He changed my mind. And He said, "I need you to help me," and I said, "Okay." And I've never looked back. Again, it wasn't in my day planner. But God's will never is. And I went to seminary, and they said, "You got to get your BA, 120 hours for that, and then you got to get a 96-hour master's degree." And I said, "Okay." And last May, I got my 96-hour master's degree after my BA. It took me 7 years, a day at a time. I'm the wrong guy to say you can't do something. Or you don't have time. I'm going to tell you, if you want to do something, God will make time. Get off your duff. Go to work, and He'll bless you. And I remember the first time somebody asked me to baptize the baby. I cried like a baby, because I never thought I'd do that. Because what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous was simply this. I found a God that had a book of everything I'd ever done. And I said, "I'm sorry." And He said, "Okay." And He erased the book. It's that simple. Now it's up to me to believe it or stay in the same old crap I always been in. The temptation is to stay in the crap. Not to be happy, joyous, and free. Eric and I went on a walk by the ocean yesterday, and I said, "Just let it wash over you. Just let those waves, they come in, wash out all the stuff. And let's leave this beach clean and free just for today." That's my God. A couple years ago, I was preaching on forgiveness. And I was right in the middle of the sermon. I was really giving them heaven because they've had enough of hell. I try not to have thin blue lips. And right in the middle of the sermon, I realized I had never forgiven the guys who killed my father, and the sermon was on forgiveness, and I stopped. And I said, I need to make a covenant with you. I need to go forgive the guys who killed my father. And I make a covenant with you that I will do that. And as God would have it, 2.5 weeks later, one of the guys' sentence got overturned. Just happened to be the one I testified against. Coincidence, huh? And the press came to me and said, Ed, what do you want to do? Because they said either release him or retry him right now. And they said, what do you want to do? I said, it's time to let him go. It's time to heal. It's time to be renewed. And he said, well, he went in prison when he was 17 years old. He's been in there 27 years. He don't know how to work. What's he going to do? And I said, he can come live with me if he wants. How dare I do anything less? How dare I, after what I've been forgiven? Who am I? Who am I? We say it every prayer. Our Father, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespassed against us. How dare I call myself a member of AA and not? And it took the world by storm. I heard from Oprah. I heard from everybody. Well, how could you do that? I said, how could I not? It's about forgiveness. It's about starting new. It's about not dragging our yesterdays into today's. You know, there's a lot of us that like that murder victim stuff. Gets you a little attention from time to time. Sorry, but it's true. And I had to consciously say, you know, I don't want to play that anymore. And as God would have it, a couple of weeks later, I was able to go up and meet this guy. I called and his lawyer set it up. And I remember walking down the halls of Fort Madison State Penitentiary that I swore I'd never go in again because my brother was there for too many times. And he came to AA and was sober 3 years and drank again, and I buried him at 36. And I'm walking down the halls of Fort Madison Penitentiary to see the guy I'd testified and wanted 5 minutes with in a room alone. And that's all I was asking for this time. And I walked down that hall, and I walked into a room, and his attorney was there, and a couple other people were there, and I stuck out my hand, and I said, Sherman, my name's Pastor Reverend Ed Mutum, and I'm here to tell you that God loves you, I love you, God forgives you, and so do I, and if there's anything in my life I can do to make your life better, let me give it to you. And I watched a heart of stone melt right in front of me. I saw the jailers cry. I saw attorneys cry. And we ended our visit and we prayed together. And then it came out that they were going to prosecute him again. And I went down to the county attorney and I said, Bill, who is a wonderful man to me, he's loved and respected me as a result of what you taught me. I went down and I said, Bill, don't retry him. Let him plead to a lesser charge. Let's give him a chance at life. Please. And he said, no, and we talked and we talked, and at the end he shook my hand and he said, Ed, I'll let him plead to second-degree murder. And the other families were not happy about it, I need to tell you. And Bill did that, and we went and pleaded. When Sherman pled to those second-degree murder charges, he just sobbed. Because you see, Sherman was 17 years old, caught in the wrong place at the wrong time. I didn't know all that in advance. But he got kind of muscled into coming along, and he was the lookout. And as soon as they started shooting, he ran. And he had paid for 28 years of his life. But he also knew that he was wrong for being there. And when he cried, and he turned, and he asked for forgiveness. He said, I don't even know who you are out there. I don't know your faces. But if you can find it in your heart to forgive me, please do. And we got out of there, and there was a lot of press, and somebody said to Sherman, this has got to be the best day of your life. He said, oh, it's a good day. He said, but the best day of my life was when Reverend Ed came in and told me he loved me and he forgave me. That's the day I became a free man. And then they said, well, Sherman, you can get out in 5 years. That was just 2 years ago. And Sherman said, oh, 5 years. And I said, Sherman, they don't know my God. My God does exactly what he wants to do when he wants to do it. I don't care about their goofy little laws and that. Just, you know, he don't get it. Sherman will be home in 2 weeks. And he's coming home, and it's going to be tough. So if you would remember Sherman in your prayers, I would deeply appreciate it. He doesn't know a lot of things we know. When I saw him last week, I said, Sherman, what's your shirt size so I can get you some clothes? He said, I don't know, Reverend. They've always given them to me. He don't know what it is to have a key to his own apartment. He don't know what it is to be able to come and go as he wants. And last week he said, Reverend Ed, if it's not too much trouble, I think I had a problem with that stuff. Can you take me to meetings with you? And I said, oh, yes. See, that wasn't a requirement for my help. There was no requirement. I'm there to be of love and service. That's what you've taught me. And there was one guy I couldn't get a hold of, and he was the shooter. And they'd put him back in the federal system because he's killed 3 other people since he's been in there. And I gave up trying to get a hold of him. And I'm in a meeting 3 weeks ago in Des Moines, Iowa, talking about restorative justice, and they had me up there to tell my little story about this because Sherman and I have become great friends. His parole is contingent on his relationship with me. Don't tell me there isn't a God. And I went up and told this story, and they said, do you have any regrets about it? I said, I only have one regret. I can't get a hold of this guy. His name's Glenn. And the woman that was leading the meeting said, Ed, I've got Glenn's address. I've been writing to him 20 years. And by the time I was home, I had his address. And I was able to write him a letter and tell him I'm sorry he's had the life he's had and that he's forgiven, and I hope that if there's any way I can ever help him, that he would let me. Now, I haven't heard back, and I don't need to, because I mean it. People ask me, how can you do that? And I said, you know, I walked into the room of Alcoholics Anonymous, and these people took me and loved me and walked with me when I was not lovable. And there was not much I wasn't capable of. I don't know about you. But in my blackouts, there wasn't a whole lot I wasn't capable of. But they loved me, and they walked with me, and you held me, and you told me it was okay to be who I am. You know, there's an old saying you hear a lot of, when you point your finger, you got 3 pointing back. You heard that? And they always talk about negative stuff, but I'm going to give you a little new tune. It works with the good stuff you see in life. If you see something good in somebody else, it's because it exists in you. Don't deny it anymore. That's what you taught me here in AA. That the goodness I saw in those old-timers and the look in their eye and the faith that they had, I could acknowledge it because there was some remnants of that in me. And all I had to do was work a day at a time and find it out. Last Wednesday, I was with my confirmation class, and they had to read some verse. I don't remember what it is. I'm sorry. But it was very, and God's love is in everybody. And, you know, it was really kind of corny. And I love my confirmation class because it was the first class. And I always say, look, I know you don't want to be here. I know Mom and Dad drug you here, so we might as well have some fun while we're here, okay? And we might as well find out if there's a God. And I said, do any of you relate to that passage about God's love and caring? And they went, no. And I said, September 11th, in the morning, when you were at school, and you heard what happened, what did you want to do? And these eighth graders said, I just wanted to do something. I didn't care who it was, what they looked like. I just wanted to do something. I said, you now know God's love. And it's for everybody. And it's equal. And it's what we need to be about. And I'm so pleased with what's happened. Because I think we're seeing God's grace everywhere. I'm seeing prayer more than I've ever seen it. I'm seeing genuine love of one another. And I celebrate your faith. I am not threatened by your faith. Please don't be threatened by mine. I hope that you can believe in your faith, whatever it is, as much as I do. Because God knows our hearts. You've taught me that here. That God knows our hearts. I try to live my life that my next action might be my last. And how do I want to be remembered? I asked my friend Chuck C. years ago, I said, Chuck, how do you pray? And he said, Ed, your every thought's a prayer. And I went, oh boy. And then I ask myself one simple question. Why am I thinking crap then? Why don't I clean it up and make my every thought a prayer? Everything I know about God I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. This year I turned 30 years sober. I was ordained and I got my master's degree. But I'd trade all that to be here with you tonight. Because that's all nice stuff. But you're my life. And you're my love. And you make me better than I've ever been. And you've given me a God that I can live with and rejoice with. It ain't about religion. It's about what's in this book. A personal relationship with God that'll solve your problem. He has mine. I hope he will yours too. Thank you.